Hop in the sleigh, fasten those seatbelts, and turn up your radio. We're going on a holiday road trip. For many of us, food is a cornerstone of the holiday season. It brings friends and family together to share memories, cultural traditions, and great flavors. And what we eat says a lot about our history as we pass recipes and traditions down from generation to generation. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. From figgy pudding to fruitcake, many foods can bring on the holiday cheer, though depending on where you live and where you're from, foods that are considered an intrinsic part of your holiday celebrations might seem strange to other people, but sharing those traditions can bring us closer together, offering us a better understanding of our cultural heritage and uniting us as we welcome new neighbors from around the world to our communities and homes. So what are the food traditions essential to your celebrations? We want to know. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. Our guest today is Luke Zahm. He is host of PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Foodie. He's also owner of the Driftless Cafe. He's a two-time winner of the Edible Madison Local Hero Award and was named a 2017 James Beard Best Chef Midwest semifinalist. Zahm and his wife Ruthie Zahm have owned and operated Driftless Cafe since 2013. Luke, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. What an fantastic opportunity.
Well, we've been looking forward to this program all week long. I got to say, much of what we eat during the holidays has been something that's been handed down to us from our parents, our grandparents, and so on. So generally speaking, what do those Wisconsin staples say about the earliest settlers here and their continuing influence on our celebrations?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to give a nod to the members of my family that handed down my sweet tooth, because like the Christmas cookie consumption for me is just out of control this year. It's straight filth. I can't help it. I see that plate and I'm just like, oh, I just need like two more, and then it's maybe like two more. But obviously, most families have a holiday tradition that they, you know, revere in some ways. And for some families, you know, it can be as much as, you know, going out to the local small town Mexican restaurant and getting some of those fajitas that are so delicious. Or, you know, it can be as grand as the big goose with all the trimmings. And, you know, it's so varied and nuanced, just like Wisconsin's cultural identity. There are so many traditions that comprise who we are as a place. And I'm just really excited to kind of get into that today.
Well, you mentioned the Christmas goose, and that's kind of one of my questions. These traditional meats of winter, how are they chosen? Who decided that the Christmas goose was the way to go, for example?
Well, I don't know exactly who chose it, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the goose. you know, I think a lot of those traditional, you know, specifically proteins, were kind of sourced through necessity. You know, if you look at some of the traditions that started before folks came from Europe, you know, I have a good buddy, Corey Geiger, who wrote this book about Bohemian life on his family farm up in the Door County area. And he's got this whole chapter about a carp for Christmas. And, you know, the Bohemian culture, they revered that carp. It was raised in like beautiful spring water in the middle of the city, and it has a very clean flavor. So Bohemian immigrants would often keep the carp in their bathtub.
Cool.
Starting about today, you know, and they would keep it fresh, and then they would prepare it for their Christmas feast. And it actually was so monumental to them that they really, really lobbied to have carp brought into Wisconsin, which is why we have so many carp in Wisconsin today. They had worked with the Wisconsin DNR to get them introduced into like local ponds and streams so that tradition could carry on. Oh. The goose is another fantastic representation of a European tradition brought here. And I think like for a lot of folks and families, the goose was this symbol of affluence. So even if you had kind of a rough financial year, putting that goose on the table really was a symbol to yourself and to your family that this was how you were going to celebrate. And, you know, personally, I don't love a Christmas goose. I think they're kind of tricky to prepare and they can be kind of stringy and gamey. But for a lot of families, that was, I mean, that was their jam.
Yeah.
That was the highlight of the entire year, is that goose on the table.
Yeah. Hey, Luke, I know that you're walking around as you're talking and we're having a little trouble with the sound. So I hate to tell you, but I think we might need to have you sit for a little bit. Okay.
All right.
Okay, cool.
If it gets worse, you let me know.
I will. Hey, my family is not of German descent, but even so, much of the German tradition is really enmeshed in our celebrations. I mean, and I feel like that's a thing throughout Wisconsin because we have so many people of German descent here. I mean, the prominence of sausage, for example. How do those German foods find their way into the mainstream and become so prominent in our celebrations?
Yeah, I mean, German culture has definitely shaped Wisconsin's dining traditions. So looking at, like, you know, older cookbooks, it's not uncommon to see where on Christmas Day, German people would, you know, go to their place of worship and they would come home and they would have a light meal of, like, wurst. So they would have sausages. They would have some of the Stollen, the fruitcakes that would kind of, you know, fortify their lunch. And then for dinner, they would go into, you know, something different and much more pronounced. So you would get into, like, some of the veal and aspic, which, you know, may be delicious. And if you're a listener at home who eats veal and aspic, I would really love it if you called in to walk me through that process. Because that sounds gross.
Yeah. I've seen that at the table, and it seemed weird to me, too. But 800-780-9742. Somebody's got to know what that's all about, right?
Seriously, it reminds me of National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, where Grandma puts the cat food in the Jell-O.
Oh.
I mean,
funny.
It's kind of that same vibe. There's so much of that tradition. You know, you get into the beer, you get into the schnitzel, you get into, like, all these things that folks from the Upper Midwest kind of hold synonymous to celebration and celebration tradition. Mm-hmm. And you're right. A lot of that comes out of old world Germany.
One thing that's popular in Germany and Austria was actually invented in Switzerland, that raclette. I had never heard about this until about a week ago. I was talking to my friend Amy, who lives in River Falls, and she was talking about this annual raclette celebration that she does with family and friends every year. And I thought, I've never heard of that. Have you heard of that before?
Absolutely. I mean, raclette, like, in some ways should be a second nature to us because we are the dairy state. But, you know, it's traditionally, it's Swiss cheese. So almost in the style of Gruyere, or if you're really familiar with Wisconsin cheeses, kind of in this, it's an Alpine style cheese. So it's very much like Pleasant Ridge Reserve that's produced in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. But what it is it's heated up. And it's melted and it's scraped. And it's scraped onto a variety of different foods. Mm-hmm. So potatoes are an easy one, but sometimes it's just scraped onto crusty bread. Mm-hmm. And it gets this sweet, nutty, aromatic. You know, my kids would say it's not a pleasant aromatic sensation. But, you know, what do they know?
Stinky cheese.
It's definitely one of those traditions that around the holidays, for a fact, I know that my daughter was in Chicago this last weekend doing a little bit of last minute shopping, and they were selling raclette on the street. And my sister-in-law, who spent some time in Scandinavian countries, like, had to stop what she was doing, put her bags down, and get that raclette because it's just so synonymous with the holidays. And, you know, it's such a beautiful and fitting Midwestern tradition.
Well, I'm intrigued. I really want to try that. And it's not fondue. It's not something that you dip, you know, something in. So it's a little bit different than that from the looks of it. And she's got some kind of special grill, but I guess a toaster oven works fine too.
Toaster oven works fine.
Okay. All right. Good. Yeah, definitely want to try that. What we in my family have a strong Norwegian background, and I know there are many Norwegians in central and western Wisconsin. I want to talk a little bit about those foods. Lefse, big tradition. Can you explain what it is?
Lapsa.
Besides just something super yummy.
You know, lefse, when at the cafe one season, and I decided, like, hey, you know what? I'm gonna put lefse on a dessert menu, and you know, really kind of try and really work into that process, because in southwestern Wisconsin, we do have a lot of Norwegian descendants, and the thing that I learned really, really quickly is nobody's lefse is as good as their grandmother's lefse.
You got that right. I cannot make it. Mm-mm.
But it's a potato bread, mm-hmm. and it's an unleavened potato bread. And so, again, it was kind of one of these foods that was built out of necessity and availability of ingredients. But for a lot of Norwegian immigrants here, it was their reminder of home. Mm-hmm. So it is quite literally a very thin, almost like a crepe batter that you spread onto a flat grill, and then you flip it with these flat sticks, these flat wooden sticks, and it has this really delicious light texture. But at the same time, it's fantastic with a little bit of butter, a little bit of cinnamon and sugar, or folks use it almost like as a table bread, or in, you know, if you thought about like Latin culture, you would think of almost the tortilla.
Yeah.
So for, you know, Norwegian immigrants, it's this flavor of home. And I think that that is kind of what a lot of the holiday traditions in Wisconsin are. They're a throwback to these places that we either originated from or came from. And, you know, it's a season to remember. Because I think specifically like in indigenous culture, winter is the time of storytelling. And that's when we have this ability to really reflect on where we came from, our year previous, or, you know, just be able to sit hopefully with the people that we love and share a meal.
Well, there are some traditions like lefse that are certainly worth passing down. There are others like lutefisk, in my opinion, not so much. What's your opinion on the lutefisk situation?
You know, for risk of getting run out of Vernon County on a rail, I'm just going to put it out there. Lutefisk is not my jam. It is. It's one of those situations that you walk into the church basement and automatically you're polarized. Either like, okay, I can get down on this, or there's no way that I'm ever coming back to this. So lutefisk is this, it's kind of like a jellied fish. And, you know, I don't even know if I need to describe it too much more. If jellied fish doesn't either sell you or repulse you, like from that moment, it's kind of a play on that. But Norwegians and Norwegian immigrants, specifically some of the older folks in our communities, they love lutefisk because, again, it's symbolic of the traditions that were passed down to them from, you know, ancestors past. And it provides them with this feeling of home. And I think that that's so much of what the holiday food traditions really imbibe here.
Luke Zalm is here as we continue our discussion about the history and significance of holiday food customs on Route 51. Ahead, we're going to talk about the new traditions that Wisconsinites are embracing as we welcome new neighbors into our communities. What's served at your holiday table? We want to know. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can email us to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. PBS Wisconsin, Wisconsin foodie host Luke Zalm is our guest today, as we discuss the foods that make our holidays so unforgettable and what they say about our cultural history. What's your favorite holiday food? You can email us, route51@wpr.org, or call us, 800-780-9742. Luke, before we move on, I want to stick with the Norwegian thing for just a little bit longer, because I would be remiss if I didn't include the thing my mom talks about all the time when her Norwegian heritage comes up, and it is gammelost. It's the worst thing ever. She said it tastes like dirty socks, and it's this weird hard crumbly cake that's like got this mold on it. And I know cheese has mold, but I mean, have you ever had it?
No, I haven't actually had it. I've heard a lot about it. Specifically, it's supposed to be an aphrodisiac. Like,
Yes.
somehow Norwegians have designated this skanky cheese as being the one thing that gets them randy during the holiday season, which is great. You know, whatever it takes. We're not here to shame anybody in their cultural tradition. But, you know, I think there is, like, one spot in Westby, Wisconsin, of course, the Ooftamart, or Dregney's pharmacy across the street, where they will have the cheese only this time of year. And I actually had an associate at the cafe who was on the hunt for it. And then when they found it so offensively smelly and unpalatable that they couldn't bring themselves to eat it.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's old school. And for people who are really into that, that idea of whatever connects them to their heritage or their ancestry through their food, you know, it's something that works for them, you know? So, no judgments.
No, no judgment here. That's for sure. So, well, we talked earlier about the ways like early settlers in Wisconsin contributed to the foods we eat, like the German settlers here. I want to ask about the wonderful ways that we've brought other cultural traditions to our table. What can you tell us about traditional Hmong food?
Sure. Traditional Hmong food has been kind of a subject of fascination for me because we have one of the highest concentrations of Hmong populations anywhere in the United States outside of even Minneapolis. So the Hmong culture had been displaced and brought here, and a lot of their food, as my friend and chef Yia Vang in Minneapolis would say, is the same way that a lot of cooks who cook farm to table really approach their cuisine. There are a few staples, though, like celebration and medicine through the food that really kind of come to light during the holiday time. One being, you know, the use of lemongrass and ginger and chicken boiled into a soup and either served with sticky rice, which is a very traditional component, or, you know, served with a lot of chilies and different sauces to kind of accompany all of that. Food is humongous in Hmong culture, and it is used as the center point of celebrations, of marriages, of life, of death. I mean, it is synonymous with how they gather and celebrate. So this summer, I actually had the fantastic opportunity to tape segments with Yia, who is actually from, you know, the Wisconsin Rapids area. And in the conversations with Yia, the Hmong culture has strong traditions that are really, really close to even some of the Wisconsin traditions. Hmong sausage, which is a really coarse grind, but it's seasoned with lemongrass and ginger, is used as a centerpiece for a lot of tables. They use fish and a lot of like Wisconsin upper indigenous fish that have been here. You know, they've adapted their palate to be here. So it's this fantastic conversation about foods that are readily available to us being highlighted and showcased on our tables from various different cultural perspectives. And I think that the Hmong people have been absolutely integrated in some ways into our food culture through their growing practices and their gardening practices. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to go to a farmer's market in the state of Wisconsin and not see amazing Hmong farmers putting out beautiful food that in some ways capture the essence of who we are as this agriculturally centered culture that is constantly shifting into new facets of culinary heights.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. And we've welcomed refugees from Afghanistan over the past year. How do you see their food traditions merging with ours as time goes on?
Well, I think, you know, that's a constant conversation in the state of Wisconsin. And that merging of culture, if it was taken and adopted from indigenous culture, which I think definitely deserves its own day in the sun, so to speak, we're all constantly learning from each other. The one thing that I adore about food and food traditions is that everybody eats. Every culture, every human on the planet does this thing three, sometimes more times a day that ties us all together and is one of the symbols of our humanity. So Afghani refugees who arrived here, I know that there was a tremendous amount of culture shock. And even folks who were around the Fort McCoy area where the Afghan refugees were resettled were bringing in ways for the Afghani people to be able to cook some of their traditional dishes, but again, using Wisconsin ingredients. Mm-hmm. So all of these other cultural ingredients that we, you know, throw out there as being ours, or maybe being of German culture, or being of Scandinavian culture, or being of indigenous culture, they kind of get looked at through this new lens of opportunity and get shifted into some of the older cultural traditions. And I think that that's one of the beautiful aspects of upper Midwestern food. It's really hard to find something that is strictly of one culture that has stayed that way, except for maybe your Norwegian cheese. that just, you know, remains in this silo of isolation. It all gets kind of worked in and shifted through the lenses of opportunity. It gets shifted through the lenses of different cultural traditions. And we end up with something that's uniquely us at the end of the day.
You talked a little bit about the indigenous cultures and those traditions. Talk a little bit more about that. What are some of the traditional indigenous winter and holiday foods?
Well, you know, I think for a lot of folks in the indigenous community, it's a time of tradition. And just like a lot of folks do around the Christmas holiday or around Hanukkah or whatever, you know, celebration that we're taking on as being quote unquote our own, the indigenous culture really looks at this wintertime as a time of storytelling and tradition. So traditional foods that you might see pop up, cranberries mm-hmm. in the state of Wisconsin is one of the first and foremost. You know, cranberries are really, really high in vitamin C, and they were hunted and gathered by native cultures all across the northern part of the state as a way to, you know, be able to brighten that wintertime palate. But it was a food of sustenance, so it prevented scurvy. And it prevented, you know, a lot of that culture being super homogenized in the food traditions that were coming into the area known as Wisconsin now around them. Additionally, wild rice. Wild rice, it's a staple for upper Midwestern and Canadian indigenous cultures. And a lot of those people actually had the ability to follow the wild rice harvest, or that's what brought them in deeper into the state. So the Menominee Nation, you know, they are a wild rice people. It is centered around them. And it's not uncommon to see on a lot of holiday tables that wild rice incorporated into different dishes or casseroles or things that people, you know, now look at Wisconsin or Midwestern food culture and be like, well, that is obviously Midwestern food culture. And in fact, we adopted that from a lot of the native inhabitants of this place when we came in and we colonized.
And corn has a big significance, too.
Corn is, I mean, we could do a whole show just on corn and the identity of corn and the pre-colonial traditions of corn and the post-colonial traditions of corn. It's one of those ingredients that have shaped indigenous culture since the beginning of time. In fact, the Oneida people just outside of Green Bay feel like there is their ancestral DNA in some of this corn that is often, you know, kind of taken for granted now. But corn is what George Washington's troops were fed in Valley Forge when they were starving by the Oneida people. And it's what actually gave them the sustenance to go forward and take the American Revolution. Unfortunately, one of Washington's first decrees was to send General Sullivan back into the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York and burn all the crops and the villages. And so the Oneida people came to Wisconsin as, you know, refugees. and they found that their corn was what actually sustained them and allowed them to keep some of their cultural traditions alive. So Wisconsin Foodie, we actually went and talked with some of these people who are still growing their sacred white corn. And Ohelagu is the name for one who walks among the corn in the Oneida tradition. And they are still growing this white corn that is so sacred to them and ensuring that their community has access to it. And what that does is it gives their people and people who have the opportunity to try or cook with this corn an understanding of their cultural position, which is so, so important as we move forward in the holidays to really understand who came before us. And if it's corn, if it's wild rice, if it's cranberries, if it's wild game, if it's stinky Norwegian cheese, all of us have a nod that we have to give to the people who were here before us. And that's what the wintertime celebrations are about. It's about creating space for those stories to come to light. And so those cultural traditions get shared forward with the next generation, who hopefully maintains that same understanding and reverence for how we got where we are.
Sure. And it's really about sharing the cultural ideas and cultural lessons and welcoming them through food. We also have a growing number of Latinos who call Wisconsin home. What traditions do they have that we're learning about here?
Well, I mean, like the emergence of the tamales, which, you know, is fantastic. Tamales are one of my favorite food. And it's something that, like, a lot of Latino families, it's easy to take for granted how difficult tamale preparation and time consuming it is. But there, I promise you, there is no gift like receiving traditional prepared tamales during the holiday season. Because once you've actually put them together, there is an appreciation for how difficult and long that process is. But tamale is like masa or corn flour, sometimes wrapped with meat, sometimes wrapped with fruit, sometimes wrapped with mushrooms that are then steamed and then served with various different sauces or other meats to accompany it. And the Latino culture in Wisconsin, you're correct, is growing in prominence. So it's not uncommon in a lot of our small agricultural communities to see these tiendas come to light. You know, Mexican grocery stores where these ingredients are now readily available to everyone. And so my big ask this holiday season is to get out and explore some of these culinary traditions that are right in our backyard. Wisconsin is not this homogenized one people that comprises all of us, and we all share the same culinary tradition and the same cultural tradition. We are quite literally a patchwork of humanity. And I think that in the upper Midwest, one of the things that's so beautiful to witness is the blending of these cultures into, you know, what has largely been considered Wisconsin's mainstream culture. So get out and explore these smaller markets, these smaller ethnic markets, as they're often referred to, because in that, that's how we create that blueprint for going forward. Some people think it's all about the political system. Some people think that that all starts in our brains, but really it starts in our bellies. And if we find one ingredient that we can latch onto and develop a relationship with the people that are providing that with us, we've done our part in creating a more homogenous conversation about who we are and our cultural identity as we move into the future.
And it's super cool to, when you find yourself at somebody's house for a celebration in the holidays, think about the differences that between their tables and yours. For example, one of my closest friends is Italian. She invited me over for Thanksgiving. It was the first Thanksgiving that I didn't do myself. And totally different. I mean, she, of course, they had the turkey and the ham, but they also had a bunch of pasta dishes and a bunch of other things. I know Italian households a lot of times do gnocchi, too, also made from potatoes. How do potatoes work its way into just about everything on our plates during the holiday season?
Yeah, potatoes are like this beautiful blank canvas that can be shaped into whatever masterpiece you find most compelling. So potatoes, specifically in the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin and around the, you know, the Central Sands region, have been a staple So many cultural traditions. You can think of the Irish, you can think of the Germans, you can think of the Italians, you can think of, you know, indigenous people who, you know, grew and harvested tubers that were growing in the forest. All of these cultural traditions have looked at this potato as being a caloric staple, specifically during the cold winter season. So, you know, I personally, big fan of mashed potatoes. Mm. I don't think that that's, there's too many, you know, wintertime tables that don't get graced with the mashed potatoes. But, you know, the roasted potatoes, the ability to take those potatoes and work them into soups, stews, different types of foods, the gnocchi, like you said, you know, cut with a little bit of flour and then boiled. There's even like the potato, you know, you're talking about the lefse earlier, that potato bread. That ingredient is a great example of how different cultures have looked at that as a staple, and it's shared. And that is like truly the essence of the winter and the holiday celebration, is the sharing of that community, that cultural tradition that unites us all, even for like one small season, and provides that shared opportunity for reflection. It provides the shared opportunity for, you know, cultural remembering and the short storytelling essence that brings us all closer together.
Well, you know, there's something to say about the what we grow here. What does the climate of Wisconsin have to do with what we eat?
I mean, the climate of Wisconsin has everything to do with what we eat. Man, it's rare. Like, if you go back pre-1900, a few seasons ago, I was researching a hotel that was opened in 1896 and recently remodeled in Viroqua, the historic Fortney Hotel. And for the opening celebration dinner, those folks did like 8 courses of food, but the first course on there was celery.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, okay. I mean, celery seems kind of bland. But celery wasn't actually grown really widespread in Wisconsin at that time. So it was this exotic vegetable, right? You know, you can go to most supermarkets now and you can find fruits from Southeast Asia, or the fact that you get red table grapes from, you know, South Africa or South America this time of year. A lot of us take that for granted.
Sure.
But, you know, you look back and farming culture and agricultural availability has shaped what we eat since forever. And I think that that is one of those things that, as we're in this season of reflection, it's so important to remember that there are people here producing that amazing food for us, making that food accessible in different cultures, different traditions have ways of bringing that to the table that is fortifying for them. But it's not a stretch to look out and see how many Wisconsinites put wild game on their tables during the holiday.
Sure.
I know that during the Thanksgiving season, you know, I don't really get into the turkey that much anymore. Turkey is kind of that, you know, ubiquitous holiday, that holiday bird, but I'm all about the venison. I'm all about having that showcase for that.
Right.
Because it's something that we've harvested. It's something that we've processed. It's something that, you know, finds its way onto holiday tables, maybe through snack sticks, maybe through summer sausage, all these ways that we take and adapt that and make it our own, so to speak. So I think that that, you know, availability is everything.
Right. You're listening to Route 51 with Luke Zahm, a discussion on holiday food traditions and how they differ from other regions of the country. Ahead, we'll talk about Wisconsin-specific holiday foods. We'll hear about traditional Jewish celebrations as well. And we would love to hear about your celebrations, too. What is the one thing you have to have during each holiday celebration? You call us at 800-780-9742 and let us know. You can also email route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
White Christmas, like the ones I used to know.
Thank you for joining us on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. It certainly is a white Christmas this year. Luke Zahm stays with us as we continue our discussion on the history behind the holiday foods at the center of our celebrations. And we want to hear from you, too. We want to hear what you're planning to serve. Email route51@wpr.org, or you can join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. Luke, what kinds of holiday traditions came out of the Great Depression in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the Great Depression inevitably shaped an entire generation of American immigrants. And I think that, you know, again, like that feeling of affluence and celebration during the holiday season for families that didn't have much specifically during that time, the culture traditions kind of got closer. So it goes again back to that availability. What did people have access to? And if it was to be their hallmark celebration for the entire year, what could they provide for themselves that indicated that there were things more important than material possessions at their table to provide them that sense of peace and prosperity that so many people look for during the holiday season? And quite frankly, you know, even today, find it so fleeting. Holidays are a really, really difficult time for a lot of people and a lot of families. And I think that, you know, a lot of times it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what we have access to. If it's Quick Trip sushi, if it's whatever, you know, you might find on your holiday table, if you have the opportunity to share that with people that you love and in a space that provides you a sense of peace and hopefully a sense of prosperity, that is what's really important. You know, Wisconsin has long been a tradition that has had agricultural prosperity. We've had ups and downs in that for sure. But the Great Depression really, really provided people a sense of the ability to look inward and find the strength in their tradition. And that is so important.
Some of these holiday traditions, too, just bring back these magical memories of our youth, too. We had James in Marshfield who sent us an email saying Christmas Eve at his grandmother's was always oyster stew. And for the kids, the only thing good about it was the little oyster crackers, you know, those little crackers I served. And then they were teenagers. Then they boycotted the oyster stew and demanded pizza. So they got the pizza. The adults still enjoyed their oyster stew. Thanks, James. I appreciate the email. But yeah, do you have anything like that personally for you, Luke, that reminds you of your childhood, that those childhood Christmases?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. James, you're right on the mark. Oyster stew is my Christmas Eve jam. And I say that like tomorrow, I don't do mine as traditionally as some people do. Like I have uncles who would just do milk and butter and oysters and then the oyster crackers. And that's fine if, you know, that's how you want to remember your holiday season.
Sure.
I prefer to kind of kick it up a little bit in the words of Emeril Lagasse. So I put a little bit of bacon in mine and some root vegetables, but still, like, oyster stew is the thing. And, you know, we have family that doesn't have the opportunity to make oyster stew, or they have a hard time finding the fresh oysters to put in there. So it gets dispersed around our family and our community when I do a big, big pot, which is on my list of things to do tomorrow. But also those oyster crackers, I'm going to eat those once a year, and I'm going to eat the living tar out of them tomorrow night. It's just going to be oyster crackers and fresh bread and cheese and a little bit of charcuterie. So it's kind of this blending of a lot of different cultures into my holiday tradition. And I love that. That's what I remember from being a kid, is being able to kind of either look forward to or dread that meal of oyster stew.
Sure, exactly. Well, of course, it's not just Christmas. We're in the middle of Hanukkah. It continues until Monday. What are some Wisconsin Jewish holiday traditions?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot. And again, it goes back to like the ingredients that we have here that are available to us. you know, you talk about potatoes, you talk about latke, or the potato pancake, that's traditionally served, you know, in Jewish culture. You know, my kids are Jewish, so we incorporate some of that in. You know, we serve ours with applesauce, quite frankly, because that's where it's at. Matzo soup, you know, and I think that that's one of those cultural traditions that comes out of the Jewish tradition that most people are relatively familiar with, that really delicious dense ball of that matzo cracker in the chicken soup, and how lovely that really is. And you know, it gives people that feeling of hope. And that kugel, noodle kugel, is one of those things that kind of gets, you know, everybody's grandmother or aunt or wherever, they have that Christmas time noodles thing that ends up in the crock pot and it kind of sits there all day. Well, noodle kugel has kind of embraced that tradition and actually preempted all of it. I really like, you know, adding a little bit of herbaceousness into my kugel, which is, you know, to take that noodle dough and sometimes add an herbed element into it. So, you know, dill is my go-to. I really like kind of, you know, increasing that up. You get a little bit of dill in that dough and you know, you basically just boil it together and then you kind of smash it into that cake and it's so good.
Oh, it sounds good. It sounds great.
Or the brisket. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so great. You know, and again, it's a roadmap for being able to take all of these cultural pockets, look at them, pay respect to the cultural traditions that they came from, and to be able to shape new traditions for generations to come.
I want to ask you about some of the more unusual things we find in Wisconsin that probably sound pretty weird to people in other areas of the country, like cannibal sandwiches. Well, we call it Wildcat at our house, and I have to have it. Yeah, we call it Wildcat. I've always called it Wildcat, and I live in Wausau, and many people here call it Wildcat. So even at the butcher shop, they call it that. Where did that come from, though? I mean, there are so many people who think that's really gross, and I love it.
Yeah, well, you know, Wildcat, as you refer to it, or, you know, the cannibal sandwich or beef tartare, it spans tremendous cultural tradition. You know, there's a lot of European, Eastern European countries that really view that as a hallmark of celebration, because the essential ingredient in that is fresh, raw meat.
Ooh, it's so good.
You don't want to use old meat for your wildcat, I promise.
No,
unless
you do not.
you want to spend New Year's in the hospital, which doesn't sound like anybody's idea of a good time. But, you know, in my family, the cannibal sandwiches were crackers, diced onions, and raw beef.
Yeah, we put it on rye bread. Mm-hmm.
On rye bread, sure, that works too. You know, and I've seen that, you know, taken and reshaped in so many cultural traditions in higher, you know, haute cuisine, where you've got that, you know, kind of poached egg on top. Or I've got a buddy in Milwaukee who served his with like whipped bone marrow.
Ugh.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. You know, but that's the reaction, right? You're like,
right. Until you
so
try
many people
it.
Look at that. Yes. Until you try it. Exactly. Don't knock it until you try it.
That's right. Can we talk about pickled herring? Because this is one thing. When my dad was alive, I had to get him pickled herring every Christmas. I've not been able to even bring myself to try it. I am 54 years old. I have never tried pickled herring. What's the deal with that? Yeah. Yeah.
Girl, you got to live. You know, take a risk. So pickled herring, you know, Scandinavian culture, that's where a lot of that originates from. And like pickling, salting, even, you know, like the lutefisk tradition was part of the essential way of preserving that food.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, you don't have the access to a lot of the foods all year round in cultures that experience winter. So, you know, that pickling of that fish, it really, really is a way to preserve it. In my family, you know, again, we eat that with the Ritz crackers. But it is, it's kind of, you know, it's the hybrid between fish that can sometimes be oily and taste really, really fishy. That's mixed with a lot of the peppercorn and the vinegar and onions. And it takes on this new and bright flavor, which is irresistible to some. And I think, like, even in Midwestern supper club culture, on most salad bars,
yes,
you find pickled herring.
Yes, you do. Right? Mm-hmm.
We love it. I, you know, my dad, that's the one thing, like, you get around the holiday season, he enjoys pickled herring. I only see him eat it around the holidays. But it's something that we keep around, and, you know, I'll try a piece or two every year, get that cute little fork that my mom puts in it, stab that piece of herring, get it on a cracker, and get it in your mouth. It's delicious.
All right, I'm going to try it. If I can eat wildcat, I can eat that, right? So I will. But here's another thing. I just saw this on Facebook this morning. A friend of mine in Phoenix had written that he had started his figgy pudding for the year. And you hear about it all the time. What is it? What's in it? I've never had that either.
You know, figgy pudding, I haven't had experience specifically with figgy pudding. You know, this one actually, it is definitely a standard in the UK. So it kind of comes from, you know, that part of the world, England. And no offense to any of my British listeners today, but it is definitely one of those pieces that I actually associate closely with, like, you know, the date cake or, you know, the rum cakes, where it's really, really, quite frankly, I look at it as a dessert element. But again, I've never had it. So maybe if you try pickled herring, I'll try figgy pudding, and we'll meet somewhere in the middle. And next year when we come to do this segment, mm-hmm. we're going to have so much more information available at our fingertips.
I like that idea. I love that idea. You're on. We'll do it.
All right.
Yes. We got about 2 minutes left in our time together. What are your three favorite things you have to have at your holiday table? Three things. Got to have it.
Okay. So three things. Tomorrow night, Christmas Eve, raw oysters. You know, we do the oyster stew, and then I'm going to shuck raw oysters. And it's amazing that people get together, and it's just kind of the way of snacking. I love it. Cheese, obviously, in Wisconsin, you know, leaning into our heavy, heavy cheese culture. I really like Upland's Rush Creek Reserve. It's a cheese that's only made this time of year.
Oh.
And it's made with the last milk of the season from the Upland's cows, which are some of the most amazing cows in the entire state of Wisconsin. No offense to anyone else out there, but it's this really soft spruce wrap cheese that you heat it up and you pour a little champagne on it. It's so good.
Sounds good.
And then last but not least, cookies.
Oh yeah.
As I indicated, you yes. know, in the beginning of the segment, cookies are my kryptonite. And so, anytime if, you know, Santa's coming to the house, Santa wants molasses cookies, and my mom kind of grew me on the molasses cookies as a kid, and they've been my favorite culinary and holiday tradition since.
Oh, so I'm all about the spritz cookies. I'm all about the spritz.
Yeah.
I had a friend bring me a box the other day, 2 days ago. They are gone already. Luke, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on. I just have really enjoyed talking with you today, and I hope you have a great holiday season.
Hey, you too, and I'll look forward to talking to you soon to figure out your feelings and opinions on pickled herring.
Hey, that's a deal. It's a date. So thanks, everyone, for joining us today on Route 51 and for including us in your lives throughout the year. I'm Shereen Seward, once again, thanking our guest, Luke Zahm, and wishing you all a very happy holiday season. Our producers today are Rick Ryer, Joy Ratch-Kramer, and Kate Springer. Rick is our executive producer. Joy is our on-air producer today. Special music from Kelly Clarkson, Pentatonix, Bing Crosby, and Gordon Lightfoot. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of each program at WPR.org/Route 51 or on your favorite podcast platform. If you have an idea for a future program or a question for our production team, email us ideas@WPR.org. Join us next week. Until then, we're heading out of town.
The lamp is burning low upon my tabletop. The snow is softly falling.
The air is still in the silence of my room. I hear your voice softly calling. If I could only have you near to breathe a sigh or two, I would be happy just to hold the hands I hold.